Welcome once again to Pretentious, a podcast about the albums and artists that have shaped the past decade of indie music culture, as chosen by PitchforkMedia.com. I'm Trevor Ickrath.
I'm Dylan Flynn. Do you remember when you had to type in PitchforkMedia.com, the whole thing?
No, I've always just known it as Pitchfork, I feel like. That's a really interesting note to start the episode off on, isn't it? Web addresses and the histories of them.
Oh, I would love to know how much the domain squatter got for that buyout. Take money out of those coffers. Oh, so good.
Dylan, our second season is going great so far, I think.
I gotta say, disagree. These last, 2 weeks have been the nadir of my pretentious experience so far. Not even as much for this record, but just for these tight turnaround ones are always a real bummer.
They're tough, but let me explain my position to you, my perspective. I really loved talking to you last month about Destroyer and Kaput, but this episode, I think, is the kind of episode that you and I have both been excited for since we started this show.
I actually agree with that 100%, as a matter of fact.
And no matter how you feel about the record that we're going to be talking about on this episode, I definitely had a very interesting time going back and reading about the critical reception to it.
Interesting is a good word for, yeah, everything.
This was the first time while doing homework for the show that I read something that made me just stand up and walk away from my computer.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
And the hype machine was, I feel like the hype machine has broken down and also just been like disseminated into a million, scattered into a million different places, you know?
I feel like we've yet to see the hype machine really working as hard as it does in this episode, which is interesting because we've reviewed an album that's gotten a 10, for crying out loud.
When you pitched this show to me, this was the kind of experience I was looking forward to. Like, what about something that had a real, that cast a real spell over us? And then we can go back in cold, sober daylight and figure out what's really fucking going on here.
We're gonna do just that. But first, let's turn the clock back and see what else was going on the week of this album's release, February 4th, 2011.
Where we're going, we don't need plugs. February 4th, 2011. In the news, the White Stripes announced that they are breaking up.
Very ironic, because this is probably going to be our whitest episode so far.
Yeah, you know, nature abhors a vacuum.
Sure.
Number one movie that week, The Roommate, psychological thriller inspired by Single White Female and starring Leighton Meester, were definitely still in the early part of the year where studios are dumping movies that suck and that I don't remember existing.
Inspired by Single White Female, I can think of a few records that would come out in the years following this one that were inspired by a single white dubstep crooner.
Always so good at roping it back into the topic, Trevor. And happy birthday to controversy magnate and first family member Hunter Biden, who turned 41.
We can only imagine how he must have celebrated.
We just got to get into that laptop, find out what that birthday bash was all about.
Know what else we have to get into?
The life and the career of a little British producer boy who could.
That's right. We're talking about that little British producer boy's self-titled debut LP, James Blake. So Dylan, what do you remember about your first experiences with this James Blake record and James Blake as an artist?
I remember when the whole kind of like bedroom dubstep producer thing was happening, kind of in the wake of the Burial moment, feeling like those guys were kind of dime a dozen and not paying very close attention to them. And then I remember a very specific single dropping by James Blake and being like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I cannot wait for this record. Being so hyped for it. Loving that single. Being like, this is going to be one of my new guys. I love this so much. This is just going to be album of the year. Let's go.
I never had that intense a reaction to any of his early stuff. The first James Blake release that I heard was actually one of his more ambient works. And I, back in 2011, I hadn't yet become the fan of ambient music that I am today. So it just kind of went over my head a bit. And my next experience with him, I think, was seeing those three EPs he released in 2010 wind up at the top of Pitchfork's Best Albums of 2010 list, as we talked about in our season one finale. And just like when we revisited that list 2 months ago, seeing those three EPs share a slot on the Best Albums of the Year list, it just didn't really pass the sniff test for me. So I kind of approached every James Blake release that came out after that with a bit of a chip on my shoulder.
I gotcha. He had something to work against for you.
Three EPs is not an album.
I loved the narrative. Here's a young, super bright young star that you thought he was going to be one kind of thing, but look, now he's this other kind of thing. Hook, line, and sinker. If I was being sold a bill of goods by the hype machine, Trevor, a sucker was born every minute. Apparently I was the sucker the minute I was born, because fuck, I just could not wait.
So you were enjoying the ride. How did you end up feeling when you finally arrived at the fireworks factory?
Okay, I remember the record dropping and my first listen and just thinking like, okay, I don't like everything here as much as I like the single. But then spending a lot of time with it over that year and it really kind of cooking up for me. And I even remember, Trevor, when I made my personal top 10 that year, I put James Blake self-titled on there. I think I had it like maybe number 5.
Yeah, these January and February releases, they can kind of go either way, you know? Like they either get the entire year to hang around and grow on you, or you kind of forget about them by March or April. Most of the memories I have about listening to this record, though, definitely take place around its release in those colder months. You know, more than anything, I think I remember feeling like this was a very timely album, perfect for soundtracking a walk out in the snow or something like that.
I know that you've always been like a very seasonal oriented music listener, Trevor. As long as I've known you, you've kind of been like, yeah, I see this more as a summer record. I see this more of an autumn record. And I definitely see where you're coming from. There is that coldness. There is that sparseness, that stillness. Very wintry.
This one never really won me over, though. You know, I think at this point, I was kind of just looking for something a little poppier. The song structures were a little over my head. So I never really fell in love with this album in the same way it sounds like you did back then.
I was kind of going through a pretty major minimalist kick at the time. I had just gotten into Music for 18 Musicians, the Steve Reich composition. And like the Nationals push into minimalism was doing a lot for me. I was getting into Philip Glass. So like it was definitely like hitting my taste buds correctly at that moment in time. But for sure, structure can be a stumbling point for a lot of that material, I think.
Yeah, a lot of the reviews from around this period praised James Blake's material for how structurally adventurous it was. And revisiting it for this episode, that was something that I found I was able to appreciate a lot more than I initially did like 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, the kind of, there's no presupposition going on. He's looking at the legacy of popular music, but he's jettisoning a lot of it and making his own rules.
So I think we've set the stage by talking about how we felt about it back in the day. Do you want to go back even farther and talk about James Blake's humble beginnings?
Buddy, I'm like a Tralfamadorian in a Vonnegut book. Time is one big amorphous blob to me. Let's drop back into the late 80s.
So James Blake was born in 1988. In London, England.
Who else do you know who was born in 88?
I don't know. Who?
This guy.
Oh,
he's
look
got
at you guys.
Two thumbs. Yeah, James Blake and I were like brothers almost.
Couple of birthday buddies over here. But yeah, James Blake is born in 1988. Shows an aptitude for music as a young boy and as a young man. He goes to Goldsmiths, University of London, where he received a degree in popular music. And he was kind of still studying there when he first broke through and started making a name for himself.
His career as a musician like had its official kickoff moment. The starting gun came with the release of his first 12-inch single, which was called Air and Lack Thereof. That was in July of 2009.
Yeah, I believe this was before either of us got on the James Blake train, right?
Oh, yeah. I had no idea. Was not cool enough or involved enough in British EDM spaces to know anything about this.
Well, let's see what we think of it now. Here's Air and Lack Thereof.
That shows vision, it certainly shows talent, and, you know, I think that it's a confidence statement. This kind of IDM-y UK garage with the sub-bass influence, you know, early stages of white boys taking over dubstep stuff, I don't find that it has a lot of space in my life. I don't really know what to do with this music. Because I feel that it draws a little too much of my focus to be a background thing, and that if I sit there listening to it studiously, I'm oftentimes a little bit bored by it.
I actually found revisiting it for the show that I most enjoyed it when I was focusing on it studiously and looking at it academically and seeing the moves he was making and where he was taking the song. Not very good background music. I would probably agree with that.
But clever.
Yeah.
And obviously, dude has some ideas, right?
Pitchfork thought just about the same thing. This was James Blake's first song, and it was also his first thing to be reviewed by Pitchfork. The A-side was reviewed by Mike Powell on November 4th, 2009.
He called it defiantly odd and defiantly little. Maybe the first qualifiably dubstep tune I've heard that actually has a sense of humor. Or maybe humor is a stretch. It has mischief.
Little is a good point, because in retrospect, it does kind of feel like a bit of an inauspicious start when you consider the kind of fire that James Blake would light under the music journalism machine's ass.
It's so funny, because this is the period of dubstep that I now think about the least.
Yeah.
Like the period of dubstep where it became like the toast of the blogs, you know? Like, it was no longer Jamaican music, which I think about that form of dubstep somewhat, but it was not yet like Skrillex maximalism wobble bass music. It was like nerdy cool kid music. I never think about that dubstep anymore.
Was Skrillex around by this point? Because I distinctly remember hearing about James Blake for the first time and seeing him build his dubstep and feeling like the dubstep that I was familiar with was that like real heavy aggressive drop driven like bro step kind of stuff.
Wham, 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 wham.
Yeah, so I put it on expecting it to be like that, but
right around this time, 2009 I think was the first Skrillex EP. So like it was kind of like two simultaneously emerging movements.
James Blake and Skrillex, really two sides of the same coin.
Imagine a horrible two-face like amalgam of them both. Oh boy.
When you die, you end up in a club in the afterlife and you have to answer a riddle and James Blake only tells the truth and Skrillex only tells lies.
Yeah, I think that I did like remember this next moment though. His first EP, The Bells, which was dropped in March of 2010, March 8th.
Yeah, The Bells sketch. Let's take a listen to this one's title track and see what we think.
Thank you.
maybe not like a vast improvement on Aaron Lack Thereof, but like you said about that other one, this is a song that I think really shows a lot of vision and has like a little bit more direction than the last single, maybe.
A pretty major improvement, in my opinion, actually, Trevor. And I think that what you hear here is still that cleverness, but you're especially hearing that education of this kid who's like been having these like very metatextual, heady conversations about popular music, how pop songs are structured, you know, how drops work, and really trying to think his way over the top of it and like find his own unique way in. This kid's 21, you know, pushing 22 years old. He's having these kinds of big ideas, and it's coming out of the music, and it is. I get the buzz. It's interesting. I see what he's going for. He's smart. He's got an ear. Yeah, that's good.
It's interesting because he almost treats each of these first couple releases as like less of a compilation of music and more like an essay or something. And I wonder if that's one of the things that got music journalists so excited about him and what attracted them to him so much.
This other quote by Mike Powell from Pitchfork that came out like a couple weeks before the EP dropped is really great. I'd love you to read it.
The conversations I've had about this track are telling. Those of us who like it think it's brilliant, and those who don't think it's a high concept mess.
It's so funny how applicable that debate seems to continue to be in the James Blake oeuvre, you know?
Yeah, it's something he would kind of never get away from, isn't it?
It's central. It's the central concept of how James Blake music is processed.
And like that review kind of concedes, your capacity to enjoy a James Blake song is kind of going to depend on your capacity to enjoy a high concept mess.
Yeah, headiness. And I mean, the kid is also going to be having his own war against his concepts and like trying to make his music more visceral and threading that needle. It's just interesting. It's interesting that already the narrative was kind of being, you know, locked down.
Yeah, so this is cool. This is the first time we get to talk about something like this. In April 2010, James Blake was the subject of Pitchfork's recurring Rising column, which is when the site's writers interview upcoming artists who have recently begun to garner significant amounts of hype.
I feel like I haven't seen this feature in a long time, Trevor. Is it defunct?
I don't know. It might be, but I'm glad that we get to like dig into it. It made me realize that this is the first like album that we're discussing that wasn't by like an established artist, you know, somebody who'd been being reviewed by the site for like a long time before the album that we're talking about came out.
We're watching myth be made. And it's fun also to see familiar name to this show, Ryan Domball, being the one to weigh in.
Yeah. And over the course of this interview, James Blake kind of outlined what his next several releases will be like. And in the interview, he drops his first reference to his forthcoming vocal album.
Here, I'll take the beginning of that quote. He says, I've planned out my future releases. I have an upcoming EP on R&S, which features almost solely R&B samples from people like Aaliyah, Brandy, R. Kelly. After that, I've got one coming where I've chopped up recordings made on a MacBook microphone. They're quite hissy, but very endearing recordings of me playing piano and singing. I've made those recordings into something quite introspective and not as danceable. My voice will still be treated, but it's less treated. That release is more about making beautiful music. I suppose all music has a bit of beauty to it, but this is a lot more personal. When my vocal album finally comes out, it'll make sense.
Nice little roadmap that he provides of like the first year and a half of James Blake's career.
He talks about his process in such a kind of unguarded way. It's weird.
Unguarded and just very meticulous. Like he has every step planned out and like he knows like how one is going to springboard him into the next thing.
Can we act out this next bit as if it's a scene?
Sure. This was my favorite part of the review, you know?
I'll be Ryan Domball, you be James Blake.
I remember when Ignition Remix by R. Kelly came out and just being absolutely embarrassed to love it.
Ignition Remix is a classic song. Do you still feel guilty for liking it?
No, because now it's cool.
He was at not even the peak of one sine wave and couldn't see the other waves that were following it in terms of R. Kelly.
Yeah, I knew that when we were going to do a James Blake episode, we'd be asking the question of has this aged well, but I didn't think we would find anything quite like this where it would just be a resounding no.
So funny. So funny. Yeah.
So the next release is like really good, in my opinion. We've got the CMYK EP, which came out on May 28th, 2010. This was the EP he was mentioning in that review where he talked about one built primarily from 90s R&B samples.
This is a big one. Hard to miss moment. You know, you got the light blue disc with the little silhouetted horse on it. Who could forget the CMYK movement if you were plugged into this shit at the time?
It's a bop. Let's take a listen.
Look, I found her.
Damn.
Red coat.
Look, I found her.
Look, I found her. Red coat.
Look, I found her.
Look, I found her.
Damn.
Red coat.
Look, I found her.
Look, I found her. Red coat.
Look, I found her.
Look, I found her.
Damn.
Red coat.
Look, I found her.
Damn. Look, I found her.
Damn.
Red coat.
Look, I found her.
I found her.
Damn.
Red coat.
Look, I found her.
Damn.
Look, I found her.
Damn. Red coat.
Look, I found her.
Flames. It slaps.
Hard to argue with that. That's awfully damn good.
This is the first James Blake material that we've listened to on this episode that really gets a reaction from me, and I like this one a lot.
I think what's cool about that piece is before that drop, you can already feel like the heavy, bouncing syncopation ideas that are going into it, even though the elements are so minimal. You know, you can feel that drop before it even comes. You're locked into the groove. It's very well put together.
Yeah, I mean, drops are more commonly associated with the brand of dubstep that somebody like Skrillex specializes in, but I don't think you can argue that James Blake does not know his way around a drop.
Reviewed again for Pitchfork by Mike Powell. Now, this is where we officially enter the best new music club, because it got an 8.3 this EP.
And Mike Powell talked a lot about the way Blake utilized the samples on the record. He said, "What makes the track isn't its samples, it's the way Blake integrates them. Everything on CMYK is remarkably balanced. Throwback sounds next to contemporary ones. Deeply processed sounds next to clean ones. Moments of dissonance and digital noise next to a constant progression of organ chords. 1 minute it's naked, the next it's obscure. Blake's songs, 3 and 4 minute long pieces of electronic pop, have no real space or time. They're not dance tracks, they're deeply retro and slightly futuristic, which is to say they're contemporary. They're made on a home computer, but sound like the work of an animatronic band."
I think that a pattern is already emerging, though, right, with the kind of eye that Blake is casting on popular music. Because, like, dating back to that first single of his, which flipped a sample of, I believe, like a slave-era gospel song, now incorporating this, like, R&B hip-hop element into it, like, and dubstep itself being this genre that had just kind of recently been wrested away from Caribbean music by the cool white kids. There's already this starting, because you remember, like, now people talk about Moby in a very different way than they used to, because he's obviously a dick, but that first record of his that was kind of all based around, like, you know, slave gospel music, there's always been this weird relationship between white producers and, like, traditional black music and black music in general. And then the question becomes, like, at what point are you an interloper? At what point are you appropriating? And at what point is the velvet rope going to be lifted for you and you'll be, like, accepted into the club? Blake's going to get there. He's going to get there. But we're still going to be having these conversations, and I've not been really looking forward to them. But especially once we get to this LP, I don't think there's any way to escape them.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like nobody was really having the conversation around him at this point in his career. Not even just during this lead-up period, but even around when his LP dropped and he had moved more into the kind of like white boy appropriating soul kind of space.
Yeah, which is so interesting because the initial blue-eyed soul movement had that backlash moment, and like Graceland by Paul Simon had had that backlash moment where we kind of like, oh, is this okay though? But it's like we have this collective amnesia, and when it's happening in front of us and it's super cool again, those kinds of like, part of it, I'm sure, Trevor, was just that like the average demographical makeup of the think piece writers of the era probably don't look like the kind of people who are thinking about culture in that like racially critical, sensitive way.
That's true. And I think like we as a culture definitely became more woke as the decade progressed, but a lot of that stuff still hadn't started happening in 2011 yet.
Yeah, and the voices were still more homogenous than they are now, so that's a contributing factor.
Yeah, Pitchfork staff definitely feels like it has grown a lot more diverse over the last 10 years, and I think that's going to play an interesting role in how the reception of this album and how the reception of James Blake as a whole has shifted over time.
But that said, all that tangly weeds stuff aside, CMYK is a fucking bop. That's a great song.
Speaking of tangly weeds, though, I also wanted to read this long quote from the end of this Pitchfork review, because it was one of the first pieces of writing that I read for the episode that really just left me scratching my head in a way that a good, like only a good Pitchfork article can.
Trevor, I've got my steak knife, I've got my entree fork, my salad fork. I'm ready to dig into this aggravating piece of music journalism. Please treat me.
So Mike Powell spends the first two-thirds of this review talking pretty intelligently about James Blake's music and like what's interesting about it. But then in the closing paragraph, he just kind of wanders off like, I don't mean to sound insensitive, but almost like an old person kind of having like a sundowning moment. Just like, yeah, critical theory about James Blake. I keep thinking of the Wong Kar-wai movie 2046, ostensibly a love story with parallel narratives, one set in the 1950s, one set in 2046. The superficial surroundings of the past are different from the future, but at one point, two characters say the same exact thing. Leave with me. The context, though, is different, and changing the context changes the meaning. And when the meaning is changed, communication breaks down. In both cases, the characters are somehow misunderstood, and the misunderstanding leads to heartbreak. James Blake plays in these gaps, these modern gaps, in ways that are both clever and sympathetic. Do androids dream of electric sheep is an old question. Blake's trying to figure out how convincingly they sing gospel.
Lost me the fuck in that thought thread, buddy.
What was all that shit about the Wong Kar-wai movie?
What does the fact that they said leave with me and we're both misunderstood have with any of that?
Well, because Dylan, you gotta see, those are the kind of gaps that James Blake plays in, and that's what makes him such a great artist.
Sure.
But yeah, wow. Like, you lost me there, buddy.
This got Best New Track, too, back when that was a thing.
Yep, and that was reviewed by Larry Fitzmaurice, who I think was the first guy on Pitchfork, at least, to point out or really praise the way James Blake makes use of negative space to create tension, which always kind of strikes me as like a backhanded compliment. Like, they talk a lot about the way he plays with silence and the silences he leaves in his track, and it's almost like they're saying, like, yeah, my favorite part of James Blake's music is when there's no music playing.
But you also know that that's exactly the kind of compliment that James Blake would love.
Yeah.
Because those silences are something he's like really like meticulously pondered. Everything's in its right little place. Every gap means something.
And we'll talk about it in a little bit, but sometimes the silences really get me too.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they're effective. They're a tool.
There's quite a lot of silence on his next release. Next up came Clavier Work, another EP, which he released in September 2010.
I don't think I listened to this one at the time. Like, I remember CMYK, and then the next one came out and me being like, yeah, I'll I'll get to that. And I don't think I ever did.
This was the first James Blake thing that I listened to, I think, because it was like a particularly slow day and I decided to just hop on Pitchfork and like listen to everything that had gotten best new track lately. And something that had gotten best new track lately was I Only Know What I Know Now, kind of deemed the like highlight of this release.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you play that for me and see if it triggers any latent memory?
All right, this is I Only Know What I Know Now. So much like he teased in his Rising interview, a lot less dancey than his previous material, a lot more introspective.
I'm getting big, like, William Basinski Disintegration Loops vibes there.
Oh yeah, it is absolutely a very ambient piece. And this was also reviewed by Pitchfork. Didn't get Best New Music, though. It only got an 8.1. It was reviewed by Joe Cawley.
He said, Blake told us back in April that this album is a lot more personal and that immediately comes through. Where CMYK was jittery and club-leaning, these tracks are much more inward-looking. And I also think that they are maybe more of a hint of kind of the roadmap that Blake is going to be taking in the future here.
It feels like this is the first release that really showcases his voice and finds him taking that first step towards being a more vocal performer.
Mm-hmm. Not 100% like stepping in front of the shroud and really like coming out with it. But, like, teasing the idea, you know?
But like Mark Richardson says in his best new track review of What I Know Now...
A theme emerges.
The lead instrument here is silence, and Blake plays it like a virtuoso. Chasms of space open up out of nowhere. There's a point 2.5 minutes in where it seems like the track has ended because one stretches on for so long, and then it ends when a ghostly voice comes floating back into the frame.
Some of these yelps are melancholy and beautiful in the mode of burial. Others seem tinged with hope and yearning, but it's amazing what can be gleaned from a few syllables. Packing so much emotional information into a tiny sonic space is something that Blake is doing better than pretty much anyone. Like you said, there is, you do start to think like, all right, well, but, you know, does that mean, what do you think of the part where he was playing?
There? Yeah, but it was clear that Blake had like learned a new trick and Pitchfork was very here for it.
Yeah, for sure. Here is the fucking moment, buddy.
This is the moment when one Dylan Flynn hops aboard Mr. Blake's Wild Ride, right? November 2010, James Blake fever is at an all-time high when What Does the Guy Do? He finally steps all the way in front of the mic for the first time and releases a cover of a Feist song, Limit to Your Love.
Put that motherfucker on.
There's a limit to your love. Like a waterfall in slow motion. Like a map with no ocean. There's a limit to your love. Your love, your love, your love. There's a limit to your care. So carelessly there. Is it truth or dare? There's a limit to your care.
this, I can picture this day. I can picture getting a text from my friend, check this out. I can see myself holed up in my little depression apartment in Eugene, Oregon. I can smell the cigarette butts that I've not cleared off of the ceramic bowl that I've been using as an ashtray for a week. I was astounded by this. I was blown away by this. I loved how poppy it was, and yet how it still kind of maintained this, like, you know, again, this cleverness, this consideration, this IDM approach. I couldn't get enough, and I still think that this feels like a culmination of a boy who's been learning a lot of tricks, showing them all to you, and you didn't realize the picture it was going to make until you see it.
This song definitely got me more excited about James Blake when I heard it than I had been in the past. But I gotta say, listening back to it for this episode, I think this might be one of the big James Blake songs that has aged the most poorly for me. I mean, it's true that all of his tricks are there and they're all working great, but the fact that they're all working overtime in service of covering a Feist song, I don't know, that seems a little weak for me.
I think that the biggest barrier, honestly, for this song is that all of these moves are everywhere now. Like, this, nothing about this feels novel. The kind of clashing of the organic and the digital, the hyper modern and the old world, the minimalist pop, like, that shit is dime a dozen now. And once you take that novelty away from it, it is a cover of a Feist song, and, you know, being that is a soul song being sung by a nerdy little white boy. So, yes, I think that, like, drop this on my plate in 2021 as we are now, I'm whatever, probably.
One thing that definitely didn't help me enjoy my revisit to this song was the tone that Pitchfork started adopting while talking about Blake's stuff around this time. Because at this point, Pitchfork is down bad for James Blake, and the reviews are going to start slobbering over him in a way that 10 years later feels extremely embarrassing.
If you hear a low whirring, it might be the sub bass after that drop. It might just be the engines of the hype machine firing at full fucking capacity.
Now, can we, like, talk about the first sentence of the Pitchfork review of this song? It got best new track.
This is unprofessional. This is embarrassing.
It made me so angry. Do you want to read it or should I?
You read it. I want to hear it in your voice with all the disdain.
Going to try not to use this space just to talk about how awesome and talented James Blake is.
Fuck off.
Like, this makes me not want to like the guy's music. I'm sorry. And that's, like, no fault of his own, but oh my God.
Tweet that. Put it up my James Blake review later today. Going to try not to use this space. Tweet that. Fine. Fucking publishing it? Ugh.
If I read an article like this, the first thing that I'm going to think is, like, oh, this guy's dad is, like, paying Pitchfork for a good review or something. This is what it feels like. And, like, it just doesn't stop either. This other quote, his approach is so minimal that it's almost cocky. After each verse, he lets the song go silent for 3, maybe 4 seconds, creating this incredible tension where you really crave the next sound. And for all the careful craft, there's still warmth, even soul, to this track, and it's that combo that makes Blake one of the most dangerous guys out there. Like, just slobbering over the dude.
Trevor, 3, even 4 seconds.
I'll hand it to the song. There is a part towards the end where I always think the song is over, and then bam, bam, and it's like, ah, oh, you son of a bitch, you got me again.
It's a cool moment. There's a swagger to it. It's an unassuming swagger.
Yeah.
It's like the boy in your class who you didn't know was the cutest boy in your class until he, like, you know, gave you a little look, and then you're like, oh.
It's cooler than you would expect a cover of a Feist song to be, but
certainly
call him, Blake, one of the most dangerous guys out there. I don't know. It feels like a stretch.
Like a fucking toothpick dangling out of his lip.
Yeah.
And he's got, like, he's got a leather jacket on. He's like, hey, Dusty, you want to hear my new track?
Got some dubstep for you. So this would end up being the first thing from the self-titled album that we would hear. In November of 2010, he finally announced the impending release of his self-titled vocal debut, James Blake.
Yeah, and I remember just, like, you know, being like, gimme, 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 gimme. I was so excited.
And Pitchfork was so excited that in the time between the release of Limit to Your Love and the self-titled album, they ranked those 3 EPs as one of the best albums of 2010, which, you know, makes sense.
If it was 48. You know, if it was number 48, I would have even been like, all right, whatever.
In the top 10, number 8.
Can't fucking do that.
Mike Powell wrote another rhapsodizing little blurb for it. He said, each EP James Blake released this year functioned like a mini essay on styles he could have spent whole albums with. Not all of them were front to back amazing. What's amazing is that they all came out in the same year.
Part of the fun of liking Blake's music was not having to wait long to hear his new ideas. We got quarterly updates, a series of variations in which he somehow managed to develop a voice so strong that people are already imitating it. Yeah, I mean, this is just like the opposite of when there's blood in the water. You know, like when there's an album or a movie that critics are just like, just horny to start piling on, and we can all feel it, and we're excited for the Paul Blart 2 reviews to start dropping. It's the opposite. It's just like the hard-ons are creaking in their professorial corduroy slacks, and we're just gonna have to listen to every nerdy white dude with a bad facial hair choice just suck this record's dick for the next 6 months. But at the time, yeah, come on. I'm here for it. Let's get ready.
They're just trying too hard to sell it, I think. Although I can see why they were so on board. It must have been like a really thrilling time for a music journalist, for this guy who's making music that is so tailored for you to think about and write about, to be releasing things like one after the other. It's a very fun ride to go on.
Here's how fucking Phantom Menace level my personal hype was. This next moment in the story, when the second single drops, you know, just a few days before the album, The Wilhelm Scream, I pointedly listened to the first 20 seconds and then shut it off because I didn't want to spoil it for myself, Trevor.
Well, we'll listen to a little more than 20 seconds right now. Here's the second single from James Blake's self-titled album, The Wilhelm Scream.
Right now I'm like, okay, shut it off, shut it off.
I don't know about dreaming anymore. All I know is I'm falling, 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 falling. Might as well fall.
So I don't remember being too blown away by this song when it came out originally, but returning to it for the show, I really enjoyed revisiting this one.
I think it's a highlight on the record. I think that there's not much I can criticize here about the musical choices that are being made here, unless I'm talking about like step way back from the project and think about its conceptual inception. But yeah, once he starts adding those little arpeggios in, it's also tasteful. It's also tasteful.
And all the sounds that he chooses are really good too. I don't think I'd ever heard anything that sounds like this song when I first listened to it. And I still haven't really.
Very funny to see Ryan Domball, on the other hand, devote the first paragraph of his review of this track to just like patiently explaining what the Wilhelm Scream is to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a little built-in gift to music journalists. Like, if you can't really think of anything to say about the song, at least you can explain what the reference is.
Webster's Dictionary defines.
Yeah,
they loved it. Hype train full speed ahead. They even gave Wilhelm Scream the 11th best song of the year nod.
I really love this one quote from the review. It almost feels like on the same level as that movie reference Mike Powell made earlier, but I love when he closes with, "Nobody's sure exactly who voiced the Wilhelm Scream, but somebody did. And there's hurt in that guttural wail." Like, just trying so desperately to, like, wring some real emotional catharsis out of the reference.
Domball, take five. Take five, Domball.
So then the album came out.
Yes, it came out. It dropped. Big day. February 4th, 2011. Pretty respectable commercially. I mean, in America, it cracked the top 200. Got up to 123 on the Billboard album sales chart. But much more of a global sensation. It went all the way to number one in Belgium and has since sold over 500,000 copies worldwide today. Not bad for the blog hype machine getting behind and pushing something.
Makes sense. I don't know a lot about Belgium, but when I think about the country, this seems like the kind of music that the people who live there would like.
Yeah, snack on a waffle, listen to the Wilhelm scream, go for
Sounds
it.
Sounds great. I'm going to do that tomorrow morning. But enough about the people of Belgium. Let's talk about what the critics thought about this record.
Okay. We're going to look at Metacritic to see that in kind of a gathered together, collected way. The average review score was 81 out of 100 based on 38 archived reviews. As usual, I went through all of them and pulled a few quotes. I would like to do this Christopher Monk one first, if I may.
Sure, hit me with it.
Christopher Monk of Music OMH gave it a 4 out of 5 and said, "Despite its many qualities, this album will inevitably disappoint those who had their hopes pinned on Blake producing the definitive instrumental dubstep masterpiece. For those intransigent souls, there will always those 3 EPs to listen to." He didn't put the word B in that sentence, so I also didn't.
Way to go, Chris.
"Everyone else can feel free to luxuriate in the wintry delights of this fine record album."
First of all, record album?
Record album. What a dork.
Are we in the 70s? I gotta say, though, luxuriating in the wintry delights is exactly what I do when I listen to this album, so he made a fair point there.
Oh, sure, like you're making a snow angel.
Yeah.
I'd love for you to take this other quote, Trevor. It's so much to unpack here.
Sure. Timothy Gabriel of Pop Matters also gave it a 4 out of 5, and he said, "Recent attempts to calibrate a modern R&B have either consisted of two reverent tweaks in the Motown Stax formula, think Jamie Liddell, CeeLo, two close approximations of Prince, Jimmy Tenor, The Dream, and Hudson Mohawk, or two severe departures into amelodicism, Jay Hayes, D'Angelo. Even so-called Afrofuturists like Erykah Badu and Janelle Monáe seem to be too hung up on the past to actually accelerate their production into the future. Blake remains thoroughly modernist on James Blake, and his clear, catchy melodic singing all the guarantees that he'll reach a wider audience." I gotta tell you, I realized what was going on there halfway through that quote. And wow.
I fucking imagine pulling a move like that. Oh my God. Even in an outfit like Pop Matters, you could never get away with something like that. Holy shit. Badu, Monáe, D'Angelo, all interlopers. James Blake is the future of R&B.
The audacity. I don't know if it's this clear, catchy, melodic singing that's what guarantees that he'll reach a wider audience. I think there might be something else there.
Could be. Could be. Maybe there's an aesthetic component.
I don't know.
Could be.
What else did the critics talk about? What were the common critical talking points?
Every review starts with a paragraph about how heavily hyped the release is going to be.
They were all aboard the James Blake train.
Pitchfork's been talking about this nonstop, and it leaked, and people were saying it was the best album of 2011 in December of last year. Like, wow, what a stage was set. Always starts there. Big talk about the minimalism and the repetition that are being employed here. And then, of course...
And of course, this was another album where the critics could not stop talking about the use of auto-tune.
They always say, like, it's going to throw some people off. Some people are going to be like, you know, this isn't on my radio. This isn't the Black Eyed Peas.
It really took us a good while to get used to the whole auto-tune thing, didn't it?
I wonder what point in this show will we stop seeing this talking point? Like, at what point...
That's a good question.
...will we finally just accept it as a tool that musicians use? Here's a weird one that kept coming up over and over again, Trevor. So many people saying... You know, James Blake might just be the guy who's going to finally break dubstep through to a giant mainstream audience.
I would say it ended up being Skrillex, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. And also, this is not really a dubstep record. I mean,
no, you know, not at all.
Props and stuff like that. So much to the point that another common talking point was the attempt to push the term post-dubstep.
Yeah, guys, stop trying to make post-dubstep happen. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. It's not going to happen. What were some of the common, like, reference points? What did people say this sounded like?
Well, of course, there was Bon Iver, there was Anthony Hegarty, there was D'Angelo, and there was Burial. Again, like on Kaput, very small pool of references that just kept getting brought up again and again and again.
I do think that's a fair enough, like, you put those things in a blender at different ratios, you're going to get this record. certainly.
Let's talk about how it ranked. Let's look at best ever albums to figure this out.
Of course, this looks at all of the kind of year-end and decade-end lists and kind of uses math to make them into one giant one. Ranked as the number one best James Blake album.
Okay, I see it. It does still, in a way, feel like the definitive James Blake long form work.
Yeah. On the other hand, ranked as the 13th best album of 2011, just behind Section 80 by Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, a rapper with whom James Blake would cross paths later on in his career, a little down the road.
Ranked as the 104th best album of the 2010s, just behind Crack Up by Fleet Foxes, an album I kind of forgot existed.
And it was ranked as the 741st best album of all time, just behind Kick by INXS.
Yeah, respectable.
Yeah.
It's a heavy hitter in your year-end stuff.
He made it to the top 800. Congratulations.
But enough of the intelligentsia. Let's talk to the vulgar, common street dweller.
Yes, the means of production lie in the hands of the average Rate Your Music user. So let's log on to RIM and see what they think.
Average user review score of 3.39 out of 5. I think that's the lowest we've encountered so far, Trevor, with 10,360 ratings counted.
A little lower than I was expecting, though. I could see those guys getting really scared away by the whole dubstep tag.
Ranked as the second best James Blake album behind Overgrown.
Which is an album where he'd moved farther away from the whole dubstep thing, so that kind of makes sense to me.
Ranked as the 262nd best album of 2011, so well out of the top 100, just behind an album called Crepuscule d'October by Four Terrasse. I believe that's a thrash metal band.
Okay, I know that RIM has a thing for weirder types of metal.
Yes, and usually here is where I would tell you where it ranks on the top of all time, but for the first time in this show's history, too low of a rating to get into the top 5,000 of all time on Rate Your Music.
Little anticlimactic after all that hype, huh?
Sorry, Blake.
Let's talk about the top rated tracks, because there was a bit of a surprise for me here. Mm-hmm. Up top at number one is The Wilhelm Scream with 4.2.
Yep.
Then Limit to Your Love with 4.0, number two. And at number three is I Never Learned to Share, 3.9. I was a little surprised to see that, although I will admit that I Never Learned to Share is one of the songs that kind of opened up a little more for me on this revisit.
I'm surprised to see it here, too. I still don't exactly get it. I think there's some things I would expect to see before it.
I would have definitely expected Lindisfarne 2 to be at that number three spot.
But on the other hand, not surprised to see Lindisfarne 1 here at the bottom rated track with a 3.2. Let's look at some top rated reviews, Trevor.
Sure. The top rated positive review by user Plato's Rave. He gave it 5 out of 5. And he said, liking this as much as I do probably makes me a whiny, self-involved dick. When the music's this good, I don't care.
And the top rated negative review user Dr. Manhattan gave it 1 out of 5 and said, I listened to this album because Natasha Khan said she liked it. I like Natasha Khan. She likes Bjork. I don't like James Blake.
Now, Dr. Manhattan, do you think we've stumbled upon a secret account that Watchmen author Alan Moore uses to roleplay as a furry music critic online?
Could be. I like how he mentions she likes Bjork. So, like, you know, she has taste.
Yeah.
She likes Bjork.
I could see Bjork being pretty big in the furry community, though. You know, she once wore a bird.
That swan.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. That's kind of like a arty take on a fursuit.
Let's get down to brass tacks here, though, and talk about the Pitchfork review, what we're all here to see.
By Grayson Curran, a name we have certainly not encountered yet on this program.
No, I don't know who the fuck this guy is, but I do know that he loves James Blake. He gave it a 9.0, and of course it got a Best New Music. And it froths and slobbers all over the guy, just as bad as some of the worst reviews that we've seen so far, I think.
It also has this, like, real messy bitch who loves drama opening, where it just, like, you know, looks through some of the IDM community infighting that's happening.
Well, Grayson clearly feels like he needs to fire up the James Blake defense squad. Yeah, he opens up this review by talking about I don't even know if it would qualify as like a minor beef between James Blake and one of the dudes from Portishead, Jeff Barrow.
It's a fucking subtweet.
Apparently, in early January, Jeff Barrow tweeted, will this decade be remembered as the dubstep meets pub singer years?
Now, he didn't say James Blake, Trevor.
No.
But that morning, James had been highlighted in the BBC Sound of 2011 poll. This is not worthy of inclusion in your review.
No, but like, Grayson is really fired up about it. He writes, Barrow's dismissal of Blake is presumably a defense of dubstep. The gesture suggests a purist, an elitist, or both. Reconsidered from the other artistic end, however, the implication is that maybe this is the decade where singer-songwriters, longtime wastrels of pianos and six strings with three chords, finally get interesting.
I don't like the way that he's phrasing that at all, first of all.
Not only is James Blake going to be the crossover star who introduces dubstep to the masses, he's also going to be the dude who finally, for the first time in like 60 years, makes the singer-songwriter genre interesting. He's finally here to do it. Thank God.
If you phrase this differently, there's a point in there, which is like, hey, maybe we won't be so rigidly traditionalist with our singer-songwriters, and they will be playing with more of these like out of piano and acoustic instrument influences. And he would have been right if he just left it at that.
But instead he makes it sound like, you know, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, all those guys are just tuning up, waiting for James Blake to show up and really show him how to do it.
He says Blake's first puts him in the rare company of fellow singers Tom York, Karen Dreyer, Anthony Haggerty, Justin Vernon, Dan Behar, who've recently bent their own lavish voices, not samples, to make interesting pop music shaped with electronics. These songs are bigger than the defense of any microgenre, and chances are they'll soon make Blake a star. He deserves it.
I just want Blake to know what a special little boy he is. He's their special little guy, and they want to give him a gold star.
Just here's a little tease. You can cut this, Trev, if you feel that it's too much dramatic irony for our trajectory. Things are gonna change. The relationship between Blake and these fucking blogs, it's going places.
It was honestly, it's been such like the prevailing narrative over the last couple years. I feel like that it was such a shock to my system to go back and see these reviews where they just like had all this unbridled fawning over him. So not only did it get Best New Music from Pitchfork, but at the end of the year, Pitchfork ranked the album as the 12th best album in 2011. And in 2014, it placed the album at number 52 on its list of the top 100 albums of the decade so far.
And then I think it misses the cutoff for the official best albums of the 2010s. How curious, Trevor.
Yeah, not only does it miss the cutoff, but the only mention of James Blake on the best albums of 2010s list at all is to point out that he appeared on Lemonade by Beyoncé. So a great microcosm of how Pitchfork has changed over the last 10 years, I think. That's so perfect.
It feels like it's been gutted and completely, like every cell in the organism has died and regenerated.
They did still like CMYK, though. They put that at number 127 on their list of the top songs of the decade.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fucking jam. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, enough Lily Gilding. The people want to know what we think about this record, Trevor.
And I've been looking forward to talking to you about it. I'll go first. I'll say that this was a record that, like I said, didn't really get much of an emotional response from me when it first came out. And it's still not one that I connect to in any real significant way. But listening to it a bunch to prepare for the episode, I did find myself kind of opening my heart to it a little. I'll never love it or get as excited about it as these Pitchfork writers did, but I can definitely respect not only how cool the sounds that Blake finds and works with on this record are, but like his unique and adventurous kind of song structures. I found myself really enjoying those aspects of the record when I sat down with it to prepare. And I'll say that like over the past day, we got a really healthy dumping of snow here in New Jersey. And I took this record out for a walk through my neighborhood just a couple hours ago, and it's no less enjoyable to revel in its wintry delights as it was all the way back in 2011.
Just a couple of snow angels just frolicking to some minimalist dubstep PBR&B.
Making a snowman and somehow managing to get his face to do that weird kind of time-lapse thing that James Blake's face is doing on the cover of this album.
Yeah, that spread blur.
Yeah. But I know that you had a real hard time with this one.
So like I said, back in 2011, my initial takeaway from this record was, okay, it's not like going to be just full of jams like Limit for Your Love. It's something else more considered. And then really, really dug my hooks into it, had a great time, ranked it in my top 10. Fuck, man, I fucking hated this record going back to it. I fucking hated it. Like,
yeah.
I have not had that experience yet. The closest I came was Age of Odds, where I thought, like, a lot of stuff to keep here, I'd make some trims. There's a couple of singles to keep here. I don't need the rest of this. I feel like it's the first moment in the James Blake story, honestly, where the concept, like, eats him a little bit. I think some of these songs are too threadbare of ideas. There's a little too much self-congratulatory, cocky minimalism happening here. And sometimes there are moments on this record where I'm just like, fucking, I'm just going to put a D'Angelo record on. I don't need to hear this kid who can kind of get into the pocket, who has, like, a vulnerable enough. So even just in, like, appealing to that, tickling that center of my brain that would love some, like, groovy in the pocket on the 2 and the 4, you know, Ray Charles falling behind that 2 and 4 a little bit. Even on that level, I can't really connect with this. I was actually moderately shocked on my, I think, second or third time through this record in preparation for the show to see that it had that 37-minute runtime, because I would have told you that it was well over the hour mark. It's a tough sit for me now.
We're definitely not in total disagreement. I do think it is more of a singles record than it is an album that you want to sit down and listen to as one cohesive piece. And especially the back half of this thing does feel really threadbare in the ideas department. Just like a lot of wandering, not a lot of direction. Definitely not all of it is as sharp as tracks like The Wilhelm Scream or Limit to Your Love. Although I do maintain that there's like some good stuff in here, and it doesn't drag as much for me as it sounds like it does for you.
Few things in recent memory have gotten my skip finger twitching than when I hear My Brother and My Sister. I'm just like, I'm not going to fucking sit here for the next 2.5 minutes and listen to you do this. I can't do it.
I think that song is like a bit of a fun journey, but when I get to tracks like Give Me My Month or the back-to-back Why Don't You Call Me and I Mind, I definitely find my mind wandering and it gets a little harder for me to pay attention. And I definitely agree that like academically and conceptually, this isn't a record that holds up very well. It sounds cool and it can be enjoyable to listen to, but when I start thinking about the implications of it, it's definitely not something that I want to passionately defend and or something that I can get very excited about.
There's still talent on display here in droves, I would say, though. Like, there's, you know, Malat, he's got a good ear. He's got a clear understanding of dynamics. Like, all that stuff's here. I just think they're one of the ingredients that maybe wasn't so apparent at the time that feels much more apparent to me now is a guy with a little bit more confidence than he's earned because the entire music journalism machine has Voltron together into one single entity to suck his dick for the last year.
Yeah, and like I said, that definitely does not do me any favors when it comes to this material. It's something that I almost have to avoid thinking about while I'm listening to the music.
But I'm not going into the rest of this episode being like, fuck you, James Blake. Because again, his sins on this record, Trevor, were my sins at the time too. I didn't have the cultural perspective to like, you know, examine what it means to make a soul record this way when you look like that and come from that background. And so why would he have, right?
Right. But, you know, the reason why we do this show is that so we can take how we feel and what we know now and apply it to these old records.
I wish that I knew what I know now when I was younger.
Yeah, unfortunately, you only know what you know now.
Fuck.
Like we've said, though, some good singles on this thing, the last of which would end up coming out several months after the album's release, a single edit version of Lindisfarne.
If you play it, you'll have played my top 3 tracks from the record, so why don't you play it?
Here's the single edit of Lindisfarne. Kestrels breathe, looking farther than I can see. Without talk to me, she'd take a shot to me. He can now fly too high. He can now. Don't fly too high. So when this one was released in its single form, it was also reviewed by Pitchfork, who gave this one Best New Track 2. It was reviewed by Larry Fitzmaurice, who said that it captured the same sense of solitude as the music of Bon Iver.
If you're Justin Vernon, are you flattered by this song, or are you a little bit like,
Well, he was clearly very excited because he would almost immediately start working with Blake.
Yeah.
I can only imagine he heard it and jumped out of his chair and ran out of his cabin and was like, this guy gets it.
Maybe Bon Iver is just a big Bon Iver fan, and he's excited for anybody who wants to make Bon Iver songs.
That's kind of the impression I've gotten about Justin Vernon. I mean, he got really into James Blake. He got really into that Francis and the Lights dude.
So this kid's got an interesting future. Trevor, I feel like at this point in the story, it could go one of a few different ways, and the way that it goes is pretty curious, so why don't we get into that stuff?
Sure, I mentioned that he collaborated with Bon Iver, and that's what happens on his next release. In August of 2011, he released Fall Creek Boys Choir, which featured him and Justin Vernon.
And that turned out to be the first single off of the Enough Thunder EP, which came out later that same year. So a big 2011 for James Blake. The dude works a lot, I will say.
This was definitely one of his most prolific periods, I think, these first couple years of his career.
And this seems to be a place where, like, maybe the hype machine is not willing to follow him to the ends of the earth, because it did not fare super well in the critical world. The average review score on Metacritic is a 64, and akin to that, Pitchfork gave it a 6.4.
Yeah, it was reviewed by Ryan Donball, who really just shredded James Blake, I think, when he said, "For those who adored Blake's heavier, more rhythmic early material, Enough Thunder could easily turn into Not Enough Thunder."
How quick the sword has turned. Come on, Blake, you're supposed to be making singer-songwriter music good for the first time. What are you doing?
So after that, Blake was reported working with Kanye West and Justin Vernon in early 2012. Kanye West even called James Blake his favorite artist during that period.
I mean, that's big. That's big, right?
Yeah.
You gotta feel like that would be a big golden boy moment.
Later that year, though, he released the single Confidence Boost / Saying, which was a collaboration with the British rapper Trim. And for that release, I guess the two of them billed themselves as Harmonics.
Yeah, Blake's gonna start playing around with how he's billing himself, I guess, moving forward. Also that year, Blake and a group of his peers, including Fote and Nick Sigsworth, formed an arts collective and record label called 1-800-DINOSAUR, which is still active today, making releases.
It wouldn't be until April of 2013, though, that he would release his second full-length album, Overgrown, which was reportedly inspired by falling in love with his new girlfriend, Warpaint vocalist Teresa Wayman. That featured guest appearances from Brian Eno and the RZA from Wu-Tang Clan.
Doesn't that feel like such a calculated cosign?
I mean, both of them.
Look at the two coolest people on the opposite sides of cool culture who love me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of like two more appropriate cosigns for James Blake than Brian Eno and the RZA.
Greatest producer of all time and greatest producer of all time here on my record.
Yeah. So that release was heavily acclaimed as well. It even won like the Mercury Prize in 2013. But it didn't get Best New Music from Pitchfork. I remember being very surprised by this. It only earned him a respectable 8.0.
Yeah, it did. It did have a big ramp up, but it couldn't get past that little 8.2 barrier, I guess. Contributing writer Eric Harvey summarized whether he's making bass-heavy bangers or quiet meditations or increasingly of late something in between. Blake is a modern master of emotional speculation.
I really enjoy this next thing we get to talk about. In July of 2014. One day prior to its release, James Blake received an email from Drake's publisher asking him for clearance to use one of his songs for a sample. And Blake denied the request. Although later, when James' publisher asked him why he turned it down, clearly disturbed, Blake asked him how much money they gave up by saying no. And when he heard the answer, he reportedly spat his drink out.
Should have signed the drink check.
Yeah, I wonder how much it was.
I'm going to guess six figures, right?
I'm surprised that he turned Drake down. What do you think that says about Blake at this point in his career?
I don't think it's very flattering.
No, not at all.
I think it shows that RZA and Eno cosign was like as calculated as I assumed it was, because he's being very careful about who he's willing to have his brand interact with. And I guess Drake was just seen as like too radio, not cool enough, no thanks.
One person that he was willing to have his brand interact with, though, was the Good Place actor Jameela Jamil, who he began dating in 2014. They're still together, and he's kind of like come to her defense for numerous PR controversies. Is that right?
Yeah, he's always making statements about, you guys are being too hard to Jamila. She's a great lady. You're all wrong about this. He's in her corner.
What's up with her? Why does she constantly need defending in the press?
She's got a goop-like attitude of being a little bit rich and out of touch and saying some silly shit about poor people.
Gotcha. So what you're saying is that James Blake and Jamila Jamil are the UK equivalent of John Legend and Chrissy Teigen. Anyways, then in December of 2014, James Blake announced his next album, Radio Silence. He said it was going to feature collaborations from Bon Iver and Kanye West, and that it would come out in the first half of 2015. But then 2015 came and went with no official word from the Blake camp.
Yeah, and then all the way into April of 2016 is when we started hearing from Blake again, this time for one of his first very big forays into that velvet rope we were talking about, when he co-wrote and was featured on the track Forward from Beyoncé's massive tentpole hit record Lemonade. He also co-wrote the opening track, Trevor, Pray You Catch Me.
Does this feel like almost an intentional follow-up to Kanye tapping Justin Vernon for My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy? Like Beyonce going like, I want one of those little white boys with a soulful voice.
Oh, certainly. And do you remember the Carters were always showing up at fucking Bumber Shoot or whatever in the back of the room when the hipster boys were on, bobbing their heads? There are famous gifs of this.
It's true. The Carters do love Grizzly Bear. I love that gif.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest power couple in music, and in some ways still to this day, they're always looking to figure out what kind of flavors they want to work with. James Blake, no fucking brainer. No brainer for a project like Lemonade, in my opinion.
So not only did he show up on Lemonade, but in May of 2016, that next album finally came out. Although it was by this point retitled The Color in Anything, and it was produced by Rick Rubin.
Yeah, the Kanye collaboration had disappeared, but Bon Iver was still there, so, you know.
Critical response to the album was somewhat positive, but Pitchfork went fully back on board. They only awarded the album an 8.2, but it did get Best New Music.
Which means we'll talk about it again in the future. Glad to know that it's a big fave of yours, though.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about that one. It is probably my favorite James Blake release to this day, although that's another record where the length frequently can be a real issue.
So then now we're off to the races, Trevor. In April of 2017, James contributed production to the song Element on Kendrick Lamar's Damn record. Reportedly, Blake was tapped because the original beat was seeming to be too jazzy. Trying to picture that in my head, and what Element would sound like with a more jazz rabbit to Pimp a Butterfly underpinning. Hard for me to kind of imagine.
Yeah, Blake definitely brought a different flavor to it. I don't think I actually knew that he was involved with that song. Although I do know that he produced two of the three bonus tracks on Jay-Z's 444 later in 2017. And he also provided guest vocals for one of them, Many-Faced God.
I think once you've produced a Jay-Z and a Beyonce song, like, you're officially in the power broker club, right?
No Kanye collab, though, it turns out. Do you think that was intentional?
I don't know. Because,
I mean, those guys kind of split over the last decade.
I don't know about that, because what happened there? Like, what happened from my favorite artist, oh my God, I'm working with Kanye West, he's going to be on this record, and then you just never hear about the two guys working. Very weird.
Yeah. He did work with Kendrick yet again, though, in January of 2018. He appeared alongside J-Rock and Future on the single King's Dead for Lamar's Black Panther soundtrack. That single reached 21 on the Billboard Hot 100.
Getting those big pop music bucks for James Blake now.
Yeah, and of course, that's the song where Future goes, la-di-da-di-da. Slow up on my nut. Who could forget?
I bet hot off of that number 21 placement, just imagine how many Drake songs he would have turned down. He would have been like, nope, nope, none of them.
He next released a single that same month, actually. He put out If the Car Beside You Moves Ahead, which was kind of like a transition back to like his earlier electronic work.
And a transition into a new chapter of James Blake, blog golden boy, and the shifting sands of the blogosphere.
Right. I remember this happening. This song prompted Pitchfork writer Kevin Lorenzo. Poor Kevin Lorenzo. He must have never known what he was doing when he wrote it. He described the song as sad boy music in a somewhat scathing assessment of the song.
And James revealed his favorite thing to do, which is to respond to high-profile negative criticism of his work. He put out his own statement, and it said, "I can't help but notice, as I do whenever I talk about my feelings in a song, that the words sad boy are used to describe it. I've always found that expression to be unhealthy and problematic when used to describe men just openly talking about their feelings."
Yeah, this definitely feels like the beginning of a new, and I guess what is the current chapter of James Blake's career? One in which he and Pitchfork don't get along quite as well as they used to. They're not so buddy-buddy anymore.
But also the career of, like, our culture, where he was like, "Oh, you don't like my song? Here's the woke bat. Bam!"
Yeah.
Sorry.
But I mean, it's a lot to think about. Is being called a sad boy just as bad as, like, being called the N-word or something? Like, I can see where he's coming from.
Yeah. I was gearing up to, like, very earnestly respond to that until that sentence took a real turn.
Yeah.
You know, there is nuance, though. You can't just say that, like, sad boy is off the table, because sad boy gets at a specific kind of, like, highly privileged individual being very kind of solipsistic in their oh-so-important pain. Like, it can be used effectively in the correct context, I feel.
Totally. And, you know, when it comes to James Blake's work, I'm not sure if it is, like, totally not, you know, unwarranted.
Yeah, sad boy, I'd lump him in the crowd.
Kind of a pioneering artist in the field. I don't get what his defense is here. Like, how do you deny it?
Blake remained active throughout 2018. Now, fully, both pens are in both ink pots. He did high-profile collaborations with both Travis Scott and 10Tricks Point Never. So he is the dividing line, my friend.
Yeah, but that rift caused by the sad boy thing would follow him throughout his next couple of releases. In January of 2019, he released his fourth full-length album, Assume Form, which kind of sonically pushed his sound in a more hip-hop-influenced direction. It featured collaborators like Travis Scott, Metro Boomin, Andre 3000. But while critical response to the album was overwhelmingly positive, Pitchfork gave the album a serious beatdown, rating it 5.8.
That's the lowest we've had from one of these artists on the show so far with a follow-up, dude. We've not gone lower than that.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
5.8. What a fucking statement score. What a statement score.
A sub-6 is a pan, any way you look at it.
Contributing editor Philip Sherburn wrote, "Assume Form is aggressively pastel and suffocatingly serious."
And James responded, like he did to the sad boy accusation, with another statement saying, "They might still be a bit upset that I called them out for their toxic masculinity." So if anybody disagrees with what you're doing, if anybody's not a fan, it's, you know, just because you're showing their ass when it comes to toxic masculinity.
It is kind of funny, though, that it's Pitchfork and James Blake essentially pointing their fingers and accusing each other of the same crime, of which they are both completely guilty.
Yeah, it's the pointing Spider-Man meme. But James has remained as prolific as ever over the last couple of years. In 2020, he released several singles and an EDM-influenced EP before, which he described as a statement of finally having confidence to put my own voice on dance floor rhythms.
And the response has been really, really hot. People love this EP.
Except Pitchfork, who neglected to review it.
Whoa! Whoa! Dusted!
Sometimes silence says more than any review ever can.
Fuck, man. What a journey we've taken with this boy and the blog who made him.
Truly. I mean, James Blake is not in the same standing with Pitchfork as he was when he was making a name for himself, to say the least.
James Blake is this podcast writ large, because we have watched him move through the spokes of the Pitchfork machine as it evolved. And as it evolved, you know, he became an unnecessary ingredient for that machine, and we saw it revolt against him. Fascinating.
It's important to consider, though, just how much the machine has changed over the course of the decade since he's made a name for himself. So let's talk about how the current version of Pitchfork would likely respond to a reissue of this album in this day and age. Do you think it would get a 10?
This is a tangly one, I feel.
It's definitely one that I had to think very long and hard about.
I wonder if it's just because of the weather, the season. You know, this is the time where we must store our goods and be careful with our sellers, make sure that they have plenty of root vegetables and dried meats and wines. I'm just not ready. I'm just not ready to put my money on the table here. I feel like right now he's practically persona non grata with Pitchfork, and I'm having a hard time seeing the moves that would have to be made in his career to kind of turn this all around. But maybe that's a, maybe I just don't have vision. Maybe I just don't have the creativity to see it.
Well, Dylan, maybe it's just because it's 2021, but I'm looking to invest, and I'm not going to buy stock in GameStop or put all my money in Dogecoin. But I am willing to put $10 down on the possibility that when this thing gets reissued, Pitchfork gives it a perfect 10.
Damn, son!
It was such an innovative record at the time, I think, and has ended up being so influential when it comes to like multiple different types of music over the last 10 years, either hip-hop or minimalist pop. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways you could say that like artists like Billie Eilish are indebted to the kind of like minimalism that James Blake was working with on this album. So yeah, I could see them wanting to reward the legacy of this record with a perfect score.
I didn't even think of this, but the other obvious way that this would happen, of course, Trevor, is that eventually Blake becomes an unassailable elder statesman music producer, becomes a Brian Eno, becomes a Rick Rubin, and is such a legend, is such a member of our cultural mythology that, of course, this is the record we'd be looking back at as the start of it all. This is his, you know, whatever, Warm Jets or whatever you want to call it. Obviously, this would get the 10 if he makes it to that level, that stratosphere.
Yeah, who knows the kind of stature that James Blake is going to occupy in popular music by the time this record does get reissued. It's going to be something you want to consider.
I'm getting that FOMO, but I'm going to hold on to my tenor. I'm going to keep it in my pocket.
Well, we're going to have to wait to see how this all shakes out. What are we going to review next month in the meantime?
What do you think, Trevor, about pop music?
Well, from New York to London to Paris to Munich, I feel like it's all anybody ever talks about.
Because next month, on the 21st of March, we got a little time off here. We're going to be looking at not an LP, but a mixtape. Of pop music by The Weeknd, known as House of Balloons. Pop, 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 pop. See what I'm getting at there, buddy?
Oh, okay. I get it. We're still in that icy R&B kind of atmosphere, though.
PBR&B should be served ice cold. Otherwise, it just tastes like warm piss.
I definitely remember this album coming out, and I'm looking forward to revisiting this era with you. But why don't you tell people where they can find us online for now?
You should follow us on Twitter. At Pre10Pod, P-R-E, number 1, number 0, P-O-D, to get, you know, updates, the occasional meme, just have some fun with us on the platform. Hey, also, why not email us? Because we'd love to hear from you. We'd probably read stuff on this show if you sent us something interesting enough. That address, very similar to the Twitter, pre10pod@gmail.com.
And while you're at your computer typing out those emails and surfing Twitter, why don't you give my friend and co-host Dylan Flynn a follow over on the tweet site at Dylan Flynn.
It's very advisable. I was making jokes about the recently deceased Dustin Diamond today on Twitter. Just contributing to what a fucking nightmare of selfishness and disgust that platform is. Doing my part, Trevor. What about you? I think they should follow you too over on Trevor Ickrath, except for you take out those E-I-O-U-Y sometimes vowels, and you make it T-R-V-R-K-R-T-H.
There's definitely plenty of selfishness and disgust to be found around those parts.
This was a lot of fun. This was kind of what I dreamt the show would be when we started it. I hope we get another one like this soon, man.
But like I said, I know we were both looking forward to an episode like this. It did not disappoint. I had a lot of fun talking to you about this record. I'm looking forward to talking to you about the next one. But that's about all the time we have for today.
So until next time, I will just say I have been Dylan Flynn.
Now I've been Trevor Ickrath.
Stick a fork in us. We're done.
There's a limit to care. So carelessly left. There's a limit to care.